Oh, we're doing audio. We're not doing video.
We can do video.
No, it doesn't matter to me, man. It's all good.
Did you do your hair?
Hola, soy Jimmy Brown de la banda Deliverance. Y estás escuchando mi capítulo segundo aquí en As the Story Grows.
Boy, I hope that's right.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Dominate.
Who's got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man, being realistic.
As the story grows.
I always wanted to be part of a small rebellion.
You got this, Travis. Make them wait for it.
Boom.
Superficial views on what my life's supposed to be. Abnorm is norm. We adopt a fractured reality. Shattered image. Human frailty is wide awake. Polished gems. A golden hue of idols that we make.
Since we've last talked, because I think I talked to you like my first 6 months being back here.
It was like, let me look it up. That's a good question. It was like the tail end of 2015. Does that sound right?
Yeah. I moved back July 29th of 2015, and that's when I was here. So yeah, you and I, that's when we last spoke.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so it's funny. It's come full circle. Now here we are talking again, and I'm heading back.
My podcast signifies a major life change for you. Starting to repeat a couple guests here. Because
right on, man.
It's cool that people are kind of circling back around and staying involved in music and doing something. And yeah, I want to talk to you about this new Deliverance album, man. This is kind of crazy that Deliverance is back on the map.
Yeah, because it wasn't really talked about when you and I talked last. We weren't really doing anything, and then that March of the next year after we spoke, we went to Mexico, and it kind of fueled a resurgence, and then it just kind of all started coming together.
Oh boy, now I have to ask, what happened in Mexico to start a resurgence for Deliverance?
Well, it was just more the forging of the lineup that went there was me, George, Ochoa, Jim, and Victor. Mm-hmm.
Deliverance played in Mexico.
Yeah, oh. We played there.
I thought y'all just went and got a great bottle of tequila, and you were like, what?
No. All right. No great Jim Morrison story in the desert. No. None of this tribal dancing and shrooms and LSD. That would have been a story.
You didn't eat like some weird tree root and see some apparition that told you to reform or whatever.
Yeah, nothing like that. That would have been exciting.
Can we change it to that? Probably make a better podcast.
It would kind of actually add a little flair to the story. I think it'd be kind of cool.
You heard it here. Deliverance dropped acid in Mexico. That's why the record. But here we are. You guys, why did you get back together? What happened in Mexico in March of 2016? What was that for?
Well, you know, we were just invited to headline the Exito Festival out there, and while the promoter treated us less than kind, but the fellow bands and the audience, the people, our fans, they were fantastic, and they were the only reason that we decided to stay and to continue with the show, because what happened was these people were completely, totally happy and excited to meet us, And, you know, we'd had a long trip from the airport to the actual venue. And it was about a 3.5 hour drive. And we got there. And of course, you know, I don't smoke in people's cars. I'm not going to do that. So, you know, I didn't do that. But the minute I got out, you know, I shook everybody's hand and then I went off to the side and lit up a cigarette. And you would have think I pulled out an issue of Jugs and started, you know, having my way with myself there. I mean, that's the way they acted. They
Are
just,
you
I mean,
it, kidding me? This is oh, still a thing.
Oh gosh. Yes. And so we, so they just started treating us like, I mean, like we were the devil because I smoked. And, we went ahead and rehearsed and then we made our way to our hotel and, but we were being treated really badly from this point on. And of course, you know, only three of us speak Spanish. Jim doesn't, but me, George and Victor speak Spanish. So, you know, we understand everything that's being said and we hear all the little queries that are happening and yeah, it's just
really,
you know, and they're just, you know, they're really upset about it. And, you know, they're saying, you know, you got to tell them to stop. They were telling our driver, you know, cause we had a driver assigned to us and he's like, I'm not going to tell them to stop. That's their business, you know? And then he told them that we asked, you know, hey, can we stop and get some beer before we go to the hotel? Mm-hmm. And I guess that was even worse. I mean, that he was, you know, it was even more horrible. So when we go to the venue, you know, I decide to go to the church service that they have. And the promoter is actually the pastor of the church there. And they're having this mini little church service. So, I mean, I told the band we should go, you know, we should go and sit in there and if anything, just listen to the message and partake in the service. And dude, this guy just started preaching about the demon of nicotine and the demon of alcohol and the demon of this. I mean, it was like, whoa. I mean, they were like just targeting us. Well, George, Victor, and Jim were like, yeah, screw this. And they left. I stayed through the whole thing. And I stared at the pastor the entire time, just looked at him, you know, and smiling, you know, because I was going to be gracious. You know, they paid to bring us out there, but, you know, I wasn't also going to stand down and, you know, and, but I mean, not once did they come and ask why, or can we pray for you? Or can, you know, can we do anything to help you? You know, this is not a good thing for you. Nothing. They just started treating us like crap. I mean, we became third class citizens. And so we did the show and it was a great show. And at the end of the, I mean, it was a rough show because, I didn't realize that the elevation levels there are higher than Denver. I mean, you're over a mile in the air, man.
Oh,
and,
wow.
So the air is real thin and it was freezing. I mean, it was like probably 30 degrees and it was an outdoor show. And, you know, we're on the stage trying to do our thing. Well, you know, at this point it was like, yeah, well, let's just do the show and have fun. And, you know, it, like I said, it turned out to be great. And, myself, Victor and Jim, this was, the first time we had jammed together in a long time. And, we decided, you know, hey, we actually all decided we wanted to do something, but, George, you know, had a lot of things going on with his worldview project and we just, you know, and George really wasn't into the path that we wanted to go. Cause if we were going to do this, I said, you know what, let's finally give the fans what they want, a hardcore thrash album.
Mm-hmm.
And let's, you know, if we're going to do it, you know, cause I said, hear what I say was the end, but you know, if we're going to do this, then let's do it right.
Okay.
And so the guys agreed. So, well, you know, we went through a couple of different ideas of who to get to play guitar and, Jim went ahead and set up the crowdfunder and, you know, we certainly overmet goal, which was great. And, people were really excited about it. And Jim's been more of the holder of that whole thing. I mean, he pretty much was the ringleader behind the whole crowdfunder and making sure the album was going to happen. Because
mm-hmm.
with me, I was already working on another project. I was working on my solo album that I was doing with John Knox and Manny Morales, the guys that did Learn and River Disturbance with me.
Okay.
So I was working with them, and so Jim spearheaded basically the revival of Deliverance. And Victor was along. We talked to a couple of different guitar players all throughout that entire time, but we went ahead and recorded the record. Mm-hmm. And but there was like no solos, and because I didn't want to play the solos, and mm-hmm. So it was just a trial and error period of, you know, finding the right guy. You know, we talked to, like I said, we talked to four or five different cats, you know, and then Greg Minear said that he would love to be a part of it and everything, but he can't like be a part of the band, but he would love to play some solos with us. So I said, yeah, that sounds great. And then I was thinking about, you know, why not get Glenn Rogers? I mean, he was with me from the beginning back in 86, 87 and all the way to the first album. And he was on the infamous Greetings of Death demo. And, you know, let me call Glenn, see if he's into it. And, you know, I reached out to Glenn and he's like, yeah, man, I'd love to. And it just kind of happened. And then Glenn laid his solos and it was cool, man. It just turned into what it's turned into.
Wow. Anybody we would know that kind of tiptoed their way through the auditions?
Oh, yeah, yeah. If I said their names, yeah, for sure.
Oh, okay. I mean, okay, and I'm not... Okay, fine. I get it. I get it. So you guys kind of felt the itch and the urge after you played that show in Mexico and decided pull it all back together. Why the direction that you guys went, and why this timing?
This, again, it was just more about, you know, if we're going to do another record, because remember, I Hear What I Say was it. I mean, I even wrote on the liner notes, I mean, goodbye, we're done. So I go, so if you're going to make me drag this out again, that's what I was telling Jim and Victor, you know, we're going to have to do our version of Rain and Blood. We're going to have to just do a balls out thrash metal record. And I think it would be a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And it just worked. I mean, Jim's a thrash hardcore drummer,
yeah,
you know, through and through. Victor's a killer bass player, but I mean, Victor can play any style, but you know, he can definitely do the thrash stuff like nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Cause he's the big Cliff Burton guy. And that's what I wanted. I wanted that Cliff Burton vibe, and, you know, and then combined with my Metallica Slayer SOD kind of thing, it just worked, you know, mm-hmm. and I just knew it was going to make magic. And so Jim flew out here, and this was while I was writing for my solo project, and Jim figured I just lost my, I mean, I'm not going to lie. There was a little drama going on between, you know, whether George was going to do this with us or not. And there was some kind of crap going on between all the members. And so Jim just decided to come out and me and him just get in a room for a weekend and just try to make something happen. Well, two songs came out of it. And one of them was The Black Hand, and then the other one was, I don't know, one of the other songs. But it just happened. It just felt right. It felt good, and it happened. And we knew, okay, yeah. And I told him, yeah, I'm committed to this. Let's make it happen. And that's the way it went.
Nice. Wow. All recorded at Three Frogs.
Yes, yes, here in Brundage, Alabama.
So how much, I didn't read, you have to forgive me, I haven't really read any liner notes on the album. Did you have, were you driving the whole thing? Did you have an engineer come in, mixing?
No, I engineered the entire record, wow. Engineered and mixed it, and then we sent it off to Rob Caldwell to master it over at Bomb Works.
Okay.
But I engineered the whole thing and me and Jim produced it.
Wow.
So, okay. Yeah, so it was, this was the first time Jim got production credit on anything. And, but Jim was a vital part of this whole thing with me. I mean, not only spearheading the crowdfunding, but Jim was with me through the entire writing process and also through, mixing. Jim flew out here a number of times, during the year before last year, you know, I mean, when we recorded, you know, he just flew out of here a number of times just that we were just making sure it was going to be 100% correct. And, you know, they were the thing that made it take so long to mix was I was fighting with the whole not wanting to use any type of triggering on the drums, and I wanted this to sound like the album was recorded in 1986, and that's what I was going for, and so I wanted it to sound big, huge, and but without being synthetic, because dude, every metal album out there, I mean, it's all the same triggers, it's all the same crap, you know, you can hear the same kick drum with the super high end on it, and and all the toms just sound, you know, just everything's super powerful, there's no tonality, there's nothing, there's no tonality or dynamics happening, it's just all like just hitting you in the head every hit, and I wanted dynamic, I wanted Dave Lombardo, I wanted mistakes and stick noise, and you know, I wanted the timing to not be perfect, I wanted it to sound like a band jamming, and that's, I think we got it. I think I hit the nail on the head with it.
I think you accomplished it. It definitely sounds live. The vibe is in the room, but I think you recorded it too well to sound like it was from 1986, just because equipment and microphones have come so far. I mean, you have to go out of your way. It's almost like, isn't it funny with the mentality that we all have, like, the best camera we've ever owned is on our phone, and then we add, like, filters to make it look like an old shitty Polaroid.
Yeah, exactly. It's totally funny, man.
You would have to record it and then like go mess it up to make it sound like 1986, you know?
Yeah. And you know, obviously I wanted it to just, when you put it on your stereo, it just kicks you in the teeth. And, you know, obviously that was at the end, you know, the mastering of course is gonna make or break any mix. And
sure.
You know, Rob, I have such a good working relationship with Rob Caldwell, and it's like he says, you know, you just give me the perfect stack of pancakes and I'll throw the butter and the syrup on there. You know, so he's great. He just did a phenomenal job with, I know we're not talking about Eraserhead, but my solo project, but
no, that's fine.
He did a phenomenal job with that, and I mean, this guy's just, he knows how to do it, but it's like he said, you got to deliver me a good stack of pancakes, because you give me a crappy stack of pancakes, there's only so much butter and syrup can do, you know.
Right. Lipstick on a pig. Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, man, let's get into this. Track one's called Bring 'Em Down.
Yeah, Bring 'Em Down. Gosh, when, you know, and I first sent it to the guys, they were just like, you know, this is cool, you know, and I'm like, yeah, but I need you guys to add your elements, you know, because I was sending guitar tracks to them out in California, and they were just kind of listening to the riffs, and I told, you know, and I remember getting on the phone with Jim and just saying, dude, just hear it, feel it, and just go with it, and I go, it's in your face, and imagine, if you will, the vocals starting right off the bat. I go, it's just gonna be in your face, and you know, because anybody who knows my formula, I don't write lyrics till the end of the record. So in other words, all the music's already recorded and then I write my lyrics. That's my formula, just always have, it's just always worked for me. I mean, I'm always writing lyrics, but I never know what's going to fit what, because I like the lyrics to fit the music. But as soon as Jim sent me back his drum ideas, I was like, yeah, this is going to be killer. And then, so when we actually tracked it and got it together, I just knew, especially what was going on with politically at the time, there was a lot of political charge going on. There was a lot of just craziness happening in the country, and especially with just even just with internals, and you know, you get me in a room with a guy like Victor, And then you put Jim in the mix. Well, you've got two devils and a saint, or you've got two saints and a devil, just depending on which hat everybody's wearing. I'm always wearing the devil's hat. But, you know, those guys, you know, they flip-flop on their hats.
That's
you know?
Because you smoke and you have demons, right?
Oh, yeah, exactly. You know, it's just you know, kind of, it's par for the course, you know. but, yeah, so I told them I'm hearing a politically charged, you know, vibe on some of these songs, and I just knew that's where I was gonna go. Now you gotta read between the lines. I never call out anybody, you know, per se. I just throw things out there. I kind of throw food for thought. So when you get that superficial live, you know, views of what my life's supposed to be, you know, abnorm is norm. We've adopted, you know, what is it? We've adopted, you got to help me out here. Do you have the lyrics in front of you?
No,
you don't. Yeah. Well, we've adopted a false reality, and it's like, and that's exactly the whole idea, because everything right now in the world, I mean, this is not the reality that, you know, we grew up with. I mean, kids and people, adults, old people are just sitting at bus stops and, you know, with their faces buried in their phones. Everybody's just, you know, completely glued to Instagram and the news and to Facebook and, you know, this crap and that crap, any type of social media. It's just, there's no people living in reality anymore. Everybody's living in the made reality. And it's just kind of led us down this trough. I mean, and think about even our president right now. Most of his communique is all done through tweeting. And it's just like, really? But, you know, in a way, you have to understand why he's doing it. And the reason being is because it seems like that's the only way people listen. People pay attention. People even take the time. You know, his twits get more hit than his actual State of the Union got viewed. And it's just like, you know, that's really, it shows the earmark of society and how we see and view things. It's all superficial, man. Gotcha. It's not real anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just kind of that vibe. That was my political bent on it, lyrical content wise with that, because it was just kind of what I think of what's happening right now.
Okay.
And that, so in other words, all this crap's happening, and you know what, in the end, we got to bring them down and, you know, and try to reestablish a real life, you know. That's where that goes. As far as our chart, you know, when we tracked it, oh my God, we had a blast. You know, we just had, you know, I remember setting up Victor, you know, poor Victor, you know, he came out here and we had a rented bass rig for him. So it wasn't his bass rig, because he flew here. He just brought his bass and his pedal board. He didn't even get to bring his pedal board. So I had a pedal board there waiting for him. And so, you know, it was just experimenting and putting all these crazy mics and effects and fuzz and all sorts of stuff, and, you know, multiple mics on his cabinet just so we can get all these crazy tones. And I just remember when we were tracking, you know, he loved playing with Jim. You know, obviously that's how they lock in and they groove.
Sure.
But since I'm engineering it, I had to lay all my guitar tracks before they got there to click tracks. So, you know, it was interesting that way, but it was cool because we were all there together. But it just, I think it made for an interesting time. I don't remember anything per se happening during the tracking of Bring 'Em Down, like a funny story or anything, other than just making it work. The cool thing about it is, you know, it didn't really take us long. I remember that, because Jim just had dialed it in.
Right. He's solid.
And then I would come over and later, which that's a whole other nightmare, because I ended up going through like four different amplifiers till I found the tone I wanted. And
you studio guys are the worst, because you have too many options.
Yeah, that's exactly it, man. And I ended up having to buy a whole new rig just because I wanted that old school sound. So I went with the Mark series amp again, Mesa, and, because, you know, I mean, I had a Bogner, I had a you know, of course, Marshall, and I had a couple of Mesa, different Mesa rigs, but
yeah.
I wanted that old nasty Mark sound. And
dude, you need that you pick, especially and bring them down. There's that one part where it's just one note.
Oh, yeah.
Rhythm. Yeah. You have to have that crispy mid. Just
because
I have to hear every up and down, or it just sounds like ah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, it came out really crunchy. I'll give you that, man. The engineering on the record is great. Honestly,
thank you.
Sounding record, and it's cool that you did it all.
Yeah, thank you.
It sounds like I'm kissing your ass. I don't mean to, but I love a decent sounding record, and then hearing oh yeah, I did it all. That's cool. You know, I like that.
Yeah.
Concept of the Other, track two.
Oh yeah, great. Again, politically bent.
You want to talk politics, don't you? I'm not saying no.
You know, I do and I don't. You know, I always I,
go
like
ahead.
I kind of like to keep my political views to myself. But I do like to give you an opportunity to read between the lines of what you think I'm trying to say.
I got you.
And
you controversial son of a bitch.
Yeah, that's me. But Concept of the Other is definitely, was concentrating on the whole crap that, you know, with the religious sects, and how we're, you know, basically, you know, the best saying I ever heard when it comes to religion is exactly this. Is it forces the concept of the other so we know clearly who to hate. That's the quote. And that's exactly what I took from this. Because there's just all this fear of all these other religions, and that, you know, that's the biggest push, especially from the and the political side, that they want to push fear. And you know, well, what is fear and what is prejudice? Prejudice, when it's broke down, is absolute fear, because you just don't know what it is. So when you start to use religion as the defining points to clearly point out who you're supposed to hate, because this is our group and that is their group, boy, you're just setting yourself up for trouble. And I think that's one of the country's biggest problems right now, is that there's just too much separation. And you know, whether you want to adhere to biblical principle, or if you want to even just say strictly from a mandated philosophical standpoint, the house divided doesn't stand. It really just doesn't. I mean, politically or religiously, whatever connotation you want to throw into it, the bottom line is a house divided doesn't stand. And that's our biggest issue right now. Everybody's so worried about what class they fit in, whether it's religious or, you know, sexuality or political bent, or, you know, it's just, there's so many labels now. You know, I remember when it was just, you know, and I'm saying this, trust me, you know, and I want it very, very clear. Like my best friend in the world is gay, you know, and it's never bothered me. But, you know, and you know, and he worked for Deliverance. He was our road manager for a number of years. And it didn't bother me that he was homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is because I can't say to him, just because a book that was written, you know, roughly, between 2,000 and 4,000 years ago, says that what you're feeling is wrong. You feel what you feel, Mm-hmm. I can't tell you that it's wrong because you feel what you feel. My bends or my sexual peculiarities or proclivities and my personal bents have no bearing on the fact that I'm just a person who wants to treat somebody else good. Mm-hmm. I want to treat others how I want to be treated. So why the concentration on all these classifications of different things? And that's exactly what concept of the other is all about. It's just that whole thing, man. And you could definitely feel the anger on the record. There's no question that I was feeling what I was singing. And I got to give it to Jim there because Jim brought a lot of that out of me.
Track 3, Center of It All.
You crave it all to be the noticed one. What's really in your hand with the DS done? Are you really that self-absorbed? You cannot see your thought processes, your centricity. You really are the center of it all. The other names you can't recall. You really are the center of it all. The ditch is dug, wait to call your fall.
Everybody has that person in their life who that their whole world just revolves around them. And whether you do say something about it or you don't say something about it, I kind of always looked at when, there's a person in your life that is that center of it all, that they are the center of it all. I don't bother even talking to them about it because there's no point, because I'd get more out of talking to a dog than I would to them because they're not going to hear you. I just had been dealing with somebody for that time and that in that place, and the song just sounded angry enough for it. And I just said, I happened to write those lyrics about this person, and I just put it on the record. And boy, that's an angry song, that's for sure. Just wrote about it. That blues guy, who was it on Dave Chappelle's show, wrote a song about it. Sounds something like this.
wrote a song about it. Want to play it for you? Yeah. Go something like this.
Yeah, that's what it was. Mm-hmm. And dealing with somebody like that, wrote a song about it. Here it goes.
Track 4, The Black Hand.
I follow conspiracy. You know, I mean, I'm all about it, man. You know, you bring bring one up to me, and if there's any validity, if there's anything that might just cause reasonable doubt, I'll start researching it. Oh yeah, I just love that stuff. I feed off of it. But Victor makes me look like some sort of, you know, once a year hobbyist. I mean,
really? Oh man.
And Victor has, you know, I'd really like to know what Victor's IQ is, because Victor is just, I mean, from the moment I met him, I knew, oh my God, this guy's just incredibly left-brained. He's super intelligent. I know he and I are going to just get along. And this was back in 89 when I met him.
Wow.
And we've always just had wonderful conversations with each other. But I mean, and we'll stay up all night just talking about this stuff. But I mean, yeah, I mean, some stuff he brings up to me, it's just like, dear God, I never even heard about that one.
Like,
man.
What? Like what? Give me in the listeners.
You're not going to give me any. I'm not going to give you any. You have to talk to Victor.
Dude, I would love to talk to Victor. Give me one rabbit hole to go down. Give me one.
Oh, gosh.
One conspiracy theory that you went, what? Like you didn't even know what he was talking about. Just one. Jimmy. Come on, James Brown.
The one that I found really interesting when we talked about Admiral Byrd.
Oh, right on.
The underworld. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the name of it.
The Hollow Earth thing.
The Hollow Earth. Yes. Yeah. He turned me on to that. That is a good read.
Dude.
It is. It's great stuff, you know. There's tons more. Like I said, all my time with Victor, we just talk about this stuff. And our favorite is Flat Earth, you know. That's our biggest one, because Victor is definitely a Flat Earther.
Is he really?
Oh, yeah. Hardcore.
Oh my God, I have to talk to Victor now, and I don't even mean that as jokingly or poking at him. I want to hear.
His argument is incredibly sound. That's the one thing I won't, you know. And the thing I love about Victor, he doesn't just like read somebody else's opinion and then spout it off as his own.
Right.
He does his own digging, and I love that. I've always loved that, and to me, that's what's important.
So what is the Black Hand specific to? Conspiracy theories overarching?
Well, it's definitely... No. I don't even know how we got onto that. What I was saying is that Jim and I had been talking about our own experiences in our lives. And some of it we want to say, well, you know, maybe a lot of it has to do with age. A lot of it has to do with psychological bents and breakdowns. And, of course, you know, when you start talking about psychology, and of course, you know, you go to Freud, and I love the old joke, you know, from Frasier and Niles, you know, because Niles is a Jungian and Frasier's a Freudian. So, you know, so when you talk to Niles, it's like he says, there'll be no blaming mother today. But Jim and I had some very similar experiences over the last 5 to 10 years. Dealing with anxiety, dealing with depression, dealing with all these different, lack of serotonin issues and all these different chemical imbalances that have happened. And that have resulted. And I guess where I was coming with conspiracies is because I do believe that a lot of this is prompted and this is going to go off on a whole other tangent. I'll try to keep it short, but our brains never rest. Our brains absolutely never rest. There's UHF. You know, it started with VHF, UHF. It started with AM, FM, all these different little frequencies. And then it turned into gigahertz, and then it turned into megahertz, and then it turned into all of these different things. And now there is so much going on in the air, in the very air, and our brain is picking every bit of it up. Even right now, just talking on the phone, the microwave technology, you know, the radio waves, the EMF, the electromagnetic fields, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Our brains are just never able to rest anymore. And some of us are just a little more sensitive to this crap than others. And so we end up affected. And you know, because I felt so alone in a lot of my anxiety issues. And my anxiety, I was diagnosed with severe chronic anxiety syndrome back in 94 or 95.
Really?
Because I just, you know, with touring and stuff, I couldn't handle being around a group of people. I could handle being on stage because I sing with my eyes closed and I don't really look at anybody when I perform.
Okay.
But, you know, put me in a crowd of people to talk, and my heart starts racing. I start hyperventilating. I feel like I'm going to pass out. I feel like something's happening to me. It's just, it's really, really tough. And you know, in 96, you know, my doctors had put me on a myriad of different medicines. I was like a 11 different pill cocktail every day. And I'd become a complete zombie. I had to just, and that's when I started, you know, I started studying a lot of different methods of trying to overcome this rather than using medication. And that's when I became an avid student of Kabbalah. It just helped me to see what was going on inside of me, mm-hmm. because that's where the problem was. That's where the issue was, you know. There's absolute validity to the chemical imbalances and all this other stuff too.
Of course.
But in the end, it is always going to relate to you and something that has happened to you or something that you might even be doing to yourself.
Sure.
Something. Black Hand approaches that subject of basically it's describing a panic attack, you know. That's what the whole song, if you've watched the lyric video, and you see the guy's nervous eye behind the lyrics, and you know, it's just all, you know, go looking all over the place, you know, because it's describing a panic attack, and it's, you know, while it's happening, what's going on, what your body is feeling, what your mind is thinking, and these places of derealization. And
I see. Okay.
And it's just trying to say there is a light at the end of the tunnel. You will get through this, but it's something that we need to address, and especially that the Christian community needs to address. And, you know, I can never, ever, ever forget that the soul core audience, or not soul, but the core audience of Deliverance fans are Christians. And there are things you have to address. And, you know, people get on me. I get emails all the time. And I hear, you know, why isn't there enough Jesus in your lyrics? And blah, 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 blah. And it's like, you know, do you need to hear the same lyrics over and over and over and over?
Yep.
Because if that's what you're looking for, well, then, you know, how many songs can be written about the plight of Noah or the Epic of Gilgamesh, as I like to say? You know, how many songs can be written about, you know, Pharaoh and Moses and the children of Israel in the desert?
Allow me to interrupt. You're asking them if they want to hear the same thing over and over and over again. I mean, have you ever been to a church service?
Well, of course, sure. You know, it just doesn't end. And it's like, you know, there is a lot more to life, and you know, but the problem is that the average Christian will hear that and get alarmed and get scared and get frightened off by that and say, so wait a minute, you're saying there's more to life than just the 66 books? And it's like, yes,
because these books were written well over 2,000 years ago. And while a lot of it is applicable, there's not a lot of relevancy to today. There is relevancy with a lot of it, but there are things today that it's like, that doesn't fit. And if you, and if the Christian that says, oh, that's not true, that is completely heretical, well, then why aren't we still stoning our children for talking back to us? You know, why aren't we taking these big Christian pastors and big Christian performers that get divorced and taking those broads and stoning them at the wall? You know, why are you still mixing dairy with your meat? You know, why is the biggest Sunday meal for the average Christian a honey baked ham? you know, I mean, if you're going to, right. In other words, if you're going to follow it, you better follow it all the way through. You know, I used to make fun of my father-in-law all the time because he was, you know, he was one of those Christians that even stayed kosher just in case. You know, total Ned Flanders. Right. You know, well, at the very least, I respected that. You know, because okay, if you feel you need to fall under that, well, then cool. You know, I understood what Paul said when he said, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are expedient. And in other words, hey, man, I'm free to do whatever I want because I don't live under bondage anymore, but doesn't mean that everything's good for me. So, you know, I mean, like I drink a ton of water. That's my main drink. I drink it with with food, with everything. I'm always drinking water. I drink probably 10 to 15 bottles a day. But I've even read those studies that say, you know, you could drink too much water where you will deplete the electrolytes and the saline and the salt out of your system. And you could actually throw your body into shock if you just drink way too much, you know? And, you know, so in other words, excess of anything, even if it's good, can be bad. It's taking what's applicable and going with it. And I just think that I write my lyrics in a way for people to get and understand that there is a lot more. What's the old Shakespearean saying? There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than that were dreamt up in your philosophy. You know, I really have always kind of loved that saying because I really believe that that is the truth of life. There's just more and more things to discover. I don't think we've reached the end of discovery. I think there's still a whole hell of a lot more out there to discover. And with that said, we need to move the church forward.
Pause for dramatic effect.
Now, where were we?
Track 5, epilogue.
Well, you know, the thing with epilogue is, you know, I approached that lyrically from this kind of stance of I blamed my fan base for where I had come and kind of being pigeonholed into the entire CCM market. So it was kind of like how I was feeling about my place in the world of Christian music. And not wanting to kind of accept the fact that, you know, I had done all this myself. I did everything myself. And I was the one who chose to sign with a Christian label and, you know, become their idea of the Christian Metallica. That's kind of the idea of like the opening line, you know, that, you know, I've created my own crucifixion, felt the asphyxiation, circled my own stage, incited the crowd's rage. It's kind of me basically saying, hey, if I'm unhappy with where things came full circle with the band and with my musical career, I did it to myself. And that's kind of the whole idea behind that song.
Sent you to change. My epilogue is written. And there's no one to blame.
blame people for not understanding, blame people for not getting it. You blame people for this and that and the other thing. And the bottom line is, if you wanted to cause controversy, you knew it was going to cause controversy, and you did it. Right. And you have to just accept it. And the sooner you do, the better you are. And it's never that I hated where Deliverance ended up and the way things are. Of course, I can't stand hearing everybody, you know, they want Weapons of Our Warfare Part 2. And it's just like, well, then listen to Weapons of Our Warfare twice through. So, it could be Part 1 and Part 2
it's
for
got
you.
Two sides.
It just doesn't make sense to me that you want it again. It's like, and if it really means that much to you, well, go buy the books that influenced the album, which was This Present Darkness and Piercing the Darkness by Frank Peretti. But that's kind of where Epilogue is, but at the same token, I say, my epilogue is written, but words continue to change, And then it says, my epilogue is written, in the end, no one to blame. So, and really it's no one to blame but me. So it's definitely the slowdown song. It's the crunchy song on the album. It's the only song I do a solo on. It was definitely a super personal song. That's why I wanted to tackle that one myself.
Track 6, Listen Closely. What's so funny?
It's funny because listen closely. I'm asking you to read between the lines. I'm asking the listener to really read between the lines. But is anything really being said? That's why I say listen. That's why it's called Listen Closely.
You've brought no clarity to track 6. Thank you very much.
It's a great track, though. Mm-hmm.
track 7.
The Subversive Kind. Subversive
Kind, yeah, man. The album is named after this one. This must be an important one.
Sure, why not?
The hell do I know?
You know, hey, I love the title. I think it's just such a great, you know, it doesn't say much, but at the same time, it says a lot. I remember going to Jimmy Swaggart Bible College in I think it was in 1986, and he was, you know, me being the only guy there attending the classes with long hair, and hearing Reverend Swaggart go up there and just talk about wolves in sheep's clothing and Christian rock and roll being of the devil. And you know, here I am, just, you know, I've been a year in the band Deliverance, and I'm here to learn from this guy who just looks at me as, you know, a wolf in sheep's clothing, you know, the devil. And I think that things like that are just so funny. There's been a lot of times that I've wanted to contact, like, you know, the Peters brothers, or, you know, whoever's writing anti-Christian rock and roll stuff out there right now, and contact them and tell them, you know, let me do an interview with you, because I want to actually confirm with you that you are absolutely right. It is the devil's music. And you know, but I do it because I like it. You know, and I think part of it is that being subversive for me is exactly what does the word subversive mean in the end? You know, it's kind of like that cover that caused so much controversy for our album, you know, with the little children, but they're holding knives and, you know, and they're bloody behind their backs, you know? Well, yeah, because they just look like regular little kids, but, you know, what is really going on there? I love offering that kind of thought, because if you don't, you know, if you won't try to subvert the system of what's happening out there, that people telling you that this is the absolute way it must be, or it has to be, or this is the way things are. Well, I want to be the troublemaker. I want to be the agitator. Because in the end, what is an agitator? They're a person that causes revolution and revolutionary change. So if you really want to get down to nitty gritty and examine the life of the man Jesus, or Yeshua ben Joseph, the minister that walked Galilee for 3.5 years, you have to say that he was the exemplary example of what the subversive kind is, because he stood against government, he stood against the religious sect of his day, and basically told the people, you don't need any of this, you just need you to get in contact with God, to reach out and create a relationship with your Father. He's the first to even bring that idea of looking at God as your Father. And because it was the most simplified way to understand the deity. And because, I mean, in the end, let's face it, do we know what God is? No. Do we really know who God is? No, we really don't. So, and it's because our finite minds can't grasp it. We can't comprehend it. It's like that interview with the alien. I don't know if you've ever seen, there's this video that's supposed to be from, you know, way back when, and you know, they're asking him, you know, where are you from? And he says, I'm from Earth, but I'm from Earth in the future. Did you see that video?
It's excellent.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Whether it's fake or not, who cares? But it's I love what he's saying. You know, and they said, well, tell us about, you know, what's going on there, and what, you know, and all this, you know, understanding the universe. So that means you've seen God. And he goes, you know, we don't have any need for myths or superstitions, mm-hmm. you know, and
And he says, but you are unable to comprehend this at this time where you're at. So that's kind of, that's who we are as a race. Unable to comprehend, using only a certain percentile of our brains. So Jesus made it as simple as possible. God's your daddy. You're a kid. You know, what kind of dad, you know, has their kid come and say, give me bread, and he hands them a rock? So, well, you know, no, of course. So, you know, if you who are evil know how to be good to your own kids, how much more God being good will give to you? So treat God like a dad. Understand that this relationship doesn't have to go through priests and people praying for you and doing sacrifices for you. You know, the prophets of old were screaming back in the old days and 2,000 years ago that, you know, I God doesn't desire the blood of bulls and goats. He desires a contrite heart. Well, what is a contrite heart? A heart that's just humble, a heart that says no to ego and puts the ego in its place and allows God to flow through him. So that's what Jesus was bringing to the people. That's why the people hated him. That's why, ultimately, if you want to just kind of put a flesh and blood story on the crucifixion of Jesus, Jesus, in a lot of ways, was just a political ping pong ball being tossed between the Roman government and the Jews at that time. And he was caught between this war between government trying to tell you what to do, or the Judaizers and the religious movement trying to tell you what to do. And he was caught right in the middle, because he was basically saying, you needn't deal with either of these people. It was like when they trapped him with the whole thing with, you know, the coin, you know, or hey, are we supposed to pay taxes and pay tithes too? I mean, what are we doing? He's like, well, hand me a coin. Whose head is on this? Caesar. Well, good. Give to Caesar that which is Caesar's. Give to God that which is God. You know, real simple, plain logic. Nothing. I mean, just straight out normal logic. And everybody was making it so hard to try to understand God. And, you know, and it still is, you know. It, you know, Jesus being subversive caused a lot of change. And I think that he's probably very, very bummed about what has happened with what he wanted to start, because it's turned into another hierarchy of Judaism. It's just turned into another offshoot and offsect of just a religious hierarchy that tries to tell people what to do, create control, and keep them under bondage. So maybe it's time that we shake it up and shake the tree again.
Final track, track 8, The Fold.
It's an anthem. It's an anthem song. Just, you know, we're not going to fold. We're not going to, you know, we're not going to let these things overtake us. We're not going to let, you know, we've covered some pretty hairy ground on this record. You know, we've talked about political things. We've talked about religious things. We've talked about depression and anxiety. We've talked about, you know, feelings of self-deprecation and feeling pity, self-pity for ourselves. We've talked about all these different ideas. And now it was the way to kind of end the record in an encouraging fashion, to say that let's unite, let's stand together, let's come together, and let's not fold. Let's make something happen. love the whole Dyer's Eve thing in the beginning. You know,
totally reminded me of that.
Yeah, it's really. Yeah, totally awesome. You know, I remember when we were tracking it, and oh gosh, Jim was struggling with it, and he was like doing these different things and these different movements, and I wasn't hearing what I wanted done on the drums. And I try not to tell any, you know, every musician I work with, I try to let them come up with their own stuff. And I mean, to me, that's the whole reason for wanting to work with the musicians you work with, because you want them to do their thing. You don't want them to do what you tell them. If that's the case, then I just need a bunch of hired guns. Sure. You know what I mean? Sure. I remember just Jim just being so frustrated. And then Victor is the one that came up with that, you know, because Victor's like, you know, it's so dynamic. Listen to what's going on, Jim, with the dun, 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 dun. He goes, it's kind of Dyer's Eve. And he looks at me and he goes, right, Jimmy? And I go, yeah, you know, I didn't even think about it, but it kind of is. And then Jim just took it from there, and dude, it just happened. It was awesome. So it's kind of like Dyer's Eve meets something off our first album, like If You Will or something. It's just got that vibe. It's really, really cool. But it's very anthemy, you know, very, very anthemy in its approach.
Still ripping off Metallica after all these years.
Oh, yeah, of course. Why not? If you're on the digital age and you need to download it, go to iTunes, go to Amazon, go to Spotify. It's on all of the digital mediums. But and then if you're a diehard and want to get a vinyl or a CD combo, just go to Rocks Records.
Rocks Records, that's it. Mm-hmm. Jimmy P. Brown II, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, man, anytime. You know that, brother.
And clear.
Go
ahead.
Visit the site at asthestorygrows.com and subscribe so you don't miss anything.
Special thanks to Brian Patton, who helps me out with the interviews, scheduling, and editing of this show.
Visit the Bandcamp link in the notes of this show for some free cover songs, some free tunes, and merch.
If you like what you heard and would like to help, there's a Patreon link on every episode. Or you can look for the $ on the website for one-time donations. One good word,
I'm gone. If you can't afford to donate, no problem. Tell a friend, and thank you so much for listening today. Oh.